Picture this. A river flows down from the peaks of mighty mountains through the rainforests of the west coast of British Columbia and down to the Pacific Ocean, passing by communities, First Nations villages, and canneries on its way to the sea. The waters are teeming with life, with salmon swimming upstream and downstream with the ebb and flow of the seasons. However, beneath that water, beneath the surface froth, is a deep undercurrent that affects all life within. Hi everyone, and welcome to our first ever episode of History Due North. I'm your host, Aaron Larson, and joining me today is Mr. Emilio Caputo from the University of Northern British Columbia.
Hey, Aaron. I'm super happy to be here on the first episode of History Due North.
All right. So let's begin by, let me just ask you a little bit about your research.
Yeah, so my research is really interesting. I'm just coming up on the stuff that I encountered in the Prince Rupert Archives, and it's part of a research that we did at the North Pacific Cannery in Port Edward. And so my findings, essentially, are that race and crime are very deeply intertwined in the cannery communities that resulted because of the labor of the salmon canning industry.
All right, would you mind giving us a little bit of context on the topic?
Yeah, absolutely. So right now I'm kind of studying at the turn of the 20th century, and so I find that to be a really important time. So to give a bit of context, I think it's important to acknowledge the history of the canning communities in general. And so we had a lot of salmon fishing that was going on. I mean, it was a really prominent resource for the First Nations communities that existed here prior. But it became really prominent for the white settlers in the turn of the 19th and 20th century when they sort of realized that it was an easily commodifiable resource. And so that was primarily because of the lack of salmon in other parts of Europe. And so the ability to export and can was really important to the foundation of these settler societies in British Columbia. I was really influenced by Bernice Mawani and her couple of works, primarily Colonial Proximities, and the ways in which these cannery communities then sort of flourished and developed beyond the actual process of canning. And so that's sort of where my research fits in as well. So I'm not really interested in what's going on at the canneries themselves. I'm interested in the community that was created because of the canneries. So to give a bit more context to my argument, I think the 20th century is really an interesting point because it sort of signifies this kind of societal change. So there were these growing tensions between these racial groups, and that was primarily white settlers, First Nations, Chinese and Japanese immigrants. Coming into the turn of the century, we see that there was initially sort of these white or these conceptions that were created by white settlers, and so these distinctions between Chinese and Japanese. But at the turn of the century, as the Japanese began to compete more with the skilled laborer positions that were initially occupied by the white settlers, we begin to see an association with many of the unfavorable attributes of the Chinese counterparts with the Japanese. So we kind of see evidence of this in the use of the term Asiatics. So the turn of the century also has this interesting turning point. There's kind of the culmination of all this resentment growing. And at the turn of the century, in 1907, there was the Vancouver riots, which sort of acted as a catalyst for this thing called the Gentlemen's Agreement that was signed in 1908 by the Japanese and Canadian governments. And so it kind of reflected the distress of these white settlers that I was talking about, but the influx over the Japanese laborers and how they provided a great degree of competition for the canning industry. So the response to this was in 1907, Prime Minister Wilfrid Laurier sent Rodolphe Lemieux, the Minister of Labor, to negotiate with the Japanese government to try and stop immigration. This is kind of similar to the Chinese head tax that was going on at the 19th century, and that was a direct result of Chinese immigration. And so now we have in 1908 a similar experience where the Japanese government assumed the role of limiting emigration from their country in order to kind of save face and maintain that imperial hierarchy. But the presence of Japanese laborers is sort of indicative of the resentment that was growing. And so you start to see the use of the term Asiatic in this era. And that's kind of why I study it, because now we have these three major groups where we have white settlers, First Nations people, and Asiatics. And within these three people, there's a sort of an association of race. And this exists in the newspapers, and it also exists in the way that the Constable Diaries as well. And it's just a really prominent part of society at that time.
Okay, so now what you're bringing up is the idea of this undercurrent of race permeating within society. And from my understanding, you learned about this from your archival research. Would you mind giving us a little bit of a background on that?
Yeah, absolutely. So what really was interesting is when I went to I visited the Prince Rupert archives there. And so there were a whole host of mediums from which I could kind of dig through before really entering my research project. And so I began to just sort of flip through things. The first thing I picked up was this 1909 edition of The Empire. And so I flipped open the first page, and on January 30th, it was on page 5, it read, "Can Prince Rupert ever be made clean, sober, and white?" And so what really stood out to me was the term white. And that sort of influenced where I went from there, because there's this distinction between how the police viewed things in the newspaper and the way in which the editor, John Houston of The Empire, the way in which he viewed things as well. And so that's where I got most of my research.
Okay, would you mind sharing some of the stories that you learned in the archives?
Yeah, absolutely. So as I was flipping through them, I found this really interesting one. It was on September 5th, 1909, the constables of Port Essington, and this is a direct quote, they raided this gambling house and arrested 19 Chinamen playing and looking on at a game of Fan Tan. And so if you're kind of unsure what Fan Tan was, as I was, it's a game similar to roulette, where these individuals then, you know, bet on a numbered squares and whatnot. And so I found this really interesting, particularly because of the association of race of 19 individuals. And so all of them were associated and then indicted, you know, subsequently recorded in the police day book in which they were charged and fined for this gambling ring. What was really interesting is that this is the first instance in all 3 years that I looked through. So I looked through 1908, 1909, 1910. And in all 3 years, I could only find one source of a gambling ring this large. But when you look at the newspapers, they talk as if this is like a routine problem, as if these Asiatic immigrants are constantly playing these gambling games and constantly sort of undermining their social values. And so it becomes like a decidedly Chinese problem. And especially when you compare that to other crimes, there's this other instance I found. So on June 13th, 1909, it was also recorded in the Constable's Day Book for Port Essington that there was a murder at the Carlisle Cannery. And murders and things like that tended to be fairly unnoticed. When they happened, they popped up in newspapers for a bit and caused a bit of ruckus, but people didn't really seem to mind. And what's interesting, too, about this murder as well is that there was no race given for the individual. It was just a very generic name, very generic murder. There wasn't really much. There was a couple pages dedicated to it because obviously it was a very large crime, a very large disruption in the community. But because it wasn't a racial problem, it wasn't given as much time in the newspapers. And there you kind of see this rift and the importance of looking at race as an actual category for the cannery communities and this and the societies they created.
So through your research, do you think that this was a problem that was only identified with the Asiatic people of the region?
I think when you're talking specifically with like supplying alcohol and opioids and gambling, it really does seem to be an Asiatic problem. And so the John Houston, the editor, routinely calls in each one of his editions, he routinely calls for the non-employment of Asiatics. And this is often undermined by his other articles in which he talks about how they can't be trusted, right? They constantly sell illegal narcotics, they sell illegal drugs, they sell illegal alcohol to First Nations people in particular. And so this sort of really undermines John Houston's idea of a clean, sober, white society. And so you kind of see this as like you said, kind of an Oriental problem, and that's the way it's really depicted, even though it isn't entirely true. And he sees it happening, and he often blames the police for not cracking down on them, even though you see a lot of evidence in the newspaper, in the constable reports, that they really were identifying Chinese in particular and other Asiatic groups as sort of the source of these problems. And so it tends to be a very racialized criminal activity.
Did you find that there were any other racial groups that were particularly demonized as much as the Asian groups within the cannery communities?
Yeah, it's actually really interesting because when you look at sort of the criminal statistics of the over the various years, you see a lot of instances and there are some petty crimes that continually show up. Drunkenness tends to be one of them, and it happens so often. I looked through this 1908 record, this list of records that happened throughout the year. and drunkenness happened so often that they started to just put those little marks below it to just indicate that it had happened before. So they would just write drunkenness, drunkenness, drunkenness. And then it happened so often that they would then just abbreviate D&D, D&D, D&D for like drunken disorderly. And what's interesting too is that when you look at this 1908 thing, when you look at this 1908 record list, they list their names, they list the crime, they list who it's paid to, things like that, you know, the penalty and all that. But they also list race. And so that's a valid category for them. For the constables of Prince Rupert, Port Essington, and all these other various communities, they often identify people based upon race and crime. And so it would be kind of naive to assume that race and crime weren't constantly intertwined in these communities. And so when you look at them, we have a long list of people that are just listed as Indian. That seems to be the most common, actually, in terms of criminal activity, which is interesting because it doesn't get a lot of airtime in the newspapers. So when you look at the First Nations people, taking into context, it was illegal for them to consume alcohol at this point in time. And so it was a crime for people to supply them, especially without a license. And that happened a lot, and it was routinely brought up in the newspapers that First Nations people were supplied by Asiatics in particular. But First Nations people were also seen as being constantly drunk. So it kind of means that these First Nations were routinely victimized and profiled in the process of law, which in turn influences how people perceived crime in their communities. And so what's interesting about that, too, is the way in which it's depicted, and they're sort of infantilized.
Could you build on the infantilization at all?
Yeah, definitely. So First Nations people, when I'm talking about infantilization, I mean within this racial hierarchy. So at the top, it's kind of crafted, you see, through the settler communities. And so you have this racial hierarchy that exists where you have white settlers as sort of like the epitome of society. And then below them is sort of First Nations people. And then below that are the various Asiatic groups. And so First Nations exist as like a separate category in terms of race. But what really separates them isn't just the name, but it's how they're treated. So they're recording as individuals deserving of like legal protection, which sort of infantilizes them, as I said, in the communities in which they exist. So it was kind of argued, rather ironically, that through the strict adherence of the law, the Indian could be introduced to the benefits of freedom through a process of legal assimilation. And so I have this evidence of this in the Empire in 1909. So on January 16th, John Houston writes, there's an Indian trouble in Hazleton, and this means that the First Nations people of Hazleton have often been found drunk and disorderly. And this is one of the first instances in which it really becomes clear that this is becoming a problem to John Houston, even though in the day books it's been a problem throughout many years, just has gone unnoticed. So keeping in mind that this occurs a year after the Gentlemen's Agreement, when anti-Asiatic sentiments are high, John Houston poses a question. He says, and I quote, "Now what real effort has the Department of Indian Affairs made to enable the Indian to reach this state," in which he means leaving the reserves. So he says, "Has the department shown itself anxious and determined to improve and develop the Indian with the ultimate view of establishing them as free and intelligent citizens?" And so kind of in this segment, he also describes them as industrious but ignorant. So they're capable of change, but they just aren't there yet.
Yeah. At the end of your research, how do you perceive the way that discipline and punishment and crime are all interrelated within a racial spectrum?
That's interesting, and that kind of speaks to why this is, I think, a necessary portion of research. So if we understand that, you know, crime happened in communities, it's sort of an inevitable part of a growing society. But if we also understand that these communities, and in relation to their crimes, were organized around the labor they contributed, then we kind of see this sort of racial distinction that's happening here. And so we start to craft our laws and our ideas about race around these individual peoples. And so when looking at the First Nations people, we kind of see their crime in like a positive light, if that makes sense, in that their punishment is constructive and not really restrictive. See, they weren't allowed to drink alcohol, but that was for their own benefit. So then when you kind of consider the contrasting role of crime in other racialized communities, we then see that these laws and legal systems, for them, are meant to assert authority and to punish offenders. So there's a very patriarchal role to crime that has a lot of implications about race. And so to put it quite simply, I think the hierarchy asserts something like this. So white people ought to have known better when they commit crime. The First Nations will eventually know better. And Asiatics simply have no place knowing at all. So the consequence in that is that these communities began to believe the racial truth that they were told. And by using race as a valid category for criminal analysis, they began to fulfill their own racial expectations. And so borrowing from Foucault's Discipline and Punish, these individuals began to police themselves by believing in these purported racial truths of their tendencies to commit particular crimes.
And what do you see as the value of this research within a modern context, now that you've finished this project and that you've been through the archives and gone through the entire historian's journey with this?
I think it's really interesting, because if you look at crime and you look at the way it impacts race and vice versa, you see these really interesting patterns sort of cropping up. And like, I keep bringing it back to the labor of the communities. So when you look at this physical boardwalk, when I went to the cannery, you kind of see a separation. So in the center, there's the cannery. On the left, there's the Europeans. And then beyond that is the Japanese. And to your right is the First Nations. And next to them is the Chinese. And so you have this physical separation of groups, this physical segregation. And I took that and I imposed it on the broader context. So I looked at the communities. I looked at the way race influenced people's perceptions of themselves and perceptions of others, and how this in turn influenced their vices. Because you kind of see, and this happens a lot in our modern day as well, when people are told that they're a particular kind of person, when they're told that their race identifies who they are and that it's a valuable category of analyzing them as individuals, they begin to associate themselves with that race. And the implication then is that these people associate themselves in these smaller communities. They band together. So when you see Asiatics, then you see Asiatic problems and you see Asiatic communities. And so their vices then reflect their racial identities. And then the problem with that too is that they're placed in a hierarchy. And so when we as a society understand race and racial truths to be a social construct, for the people of Prince Rupert, race was very real and it influenced how these people interacted with one another in the broader community. And so what kind of leads me to these conclusions is looking beyond the ramblings of John Huston and understanding that this was a sentiment widely disseminated. And so when we look at race and how it influenced crime, we kind of understand the origins of our society and how we're reeling from the impacts of criminality and how we associate people's race and their racial identities and how we formulate racial truths with the crimes in which they commit and how this in turn causes them to commit those crimes. And so if we really face the fact that race has become a true category for us, and we then subsequently dismantle it, I think we'll be a better peoples for it.
All right. Thank you very much, Emilio. It was a pleasure having you on the show today.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for having me.
I'd like to thank you, the listener, as well. And most of all, I would like to give a sincere thanks to the Prince Rupert Archives and the North Pacific Cannery National Historic Site for allowing UNBC students to visit the cannery and delve into history as it should be, deep in the archives, and learning a few stories about what it means to be Northern and what it means to be part of that canning community. All right, and until next time, this is Aaron Larson, your host of History Due North. Cheers.
Thank you.